WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Tolstoy's classic novel from Imperial Russia, Anna Karenina, is back on the big screen. It's a story of passion, adultery, and despair of a young woman, Anna, who spurns a settled husband for a bold lover, Vronsky, and whose pursuit of that love and those closest brings her and those closest to her tremendous sorrow. And us, a great journey. This hour on Point, an old story back again in more ways than one. We are rereading Anna Karenina. You can join the conversation. Will Keira Knightley tempt you to see Anna Karenina? Will Tolstoy tempt you back to the book, The Eternal Story? What does it tell us? Now, you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. In a moment, two wonderful Tolstoy scholars and readers of Anna Karenina. But first, to Hollywood's latest take, Washington Post movie critic Anne Hornaday joins us. Anne, thanks very much for being here. What did you think?
I just love this movie, Tom. It really transported me. And just coincidentally, purely coincidentally, I had decided to dive back into the book last winter. You know, there's something about the Russians in the wintertime that makes them an ideal read when you're below lots of blankets.
Yes.
And I, you know, it's one of those novels that yields different rewards depending on what stage of life you read them in. And I just, there were so many different meanings that I took from it this time compared to the last time I read it. So it was very fresh in my mind when I saw the movie at the Toronto International Film Festival this year. And it is such a radical reimagining of the book. For one thing, the director, Joe Wright, has staged it entirely within this little jewel box theater and staged it almost like a light operetta and sort of transfers between scenes by way of scenery changes and camera moves and kind of theatrical conceits rather than conventional cinematic ones, which you would, and so he sort of miniaturizes this sprawling epic novel, which you would think would take away from its essential meaning, but instead he's, I think, to my mind, with the book so fresh in my mind, he utterly grasped the most important elements of the story and the most important, and he brought some often forgotten characters into the fore, which I found immensely gratifying.
Miniaturizes in a way, it's often that his visual conceit is that we're on a kind of stage set, but it's very, it's a kind of surreal stage set that swirls here and there, that changes. We're up, in the ropes and pulleys and then down on the dance floor, and then
exactly,
we step through a door and we're out into the steppe or the tundra or something.
Exactly, we're at the dasha, you know, and it's just, it's, and I think what makes it work so beautifully is many things, but one is that he was working from a script by the incomparable Tom Stoppard. So when you're, you know, when you're starting with words that have come, you know, that have been channeled from Tolstoy through Tom Stoppard, you're starting, you know, with a very strong hand. But from what I gather, I interviewed Joe Wright a few weeks ago, and Stoppard's script was a more conventional cinematic script in terms of scenes and carriages pulling up to doorways and people walking into doors, and you know, it was a much more conventionally staged thing. And Wright had the stroke of utter genius to condense it and compress it and stage it in the way you just described.
What does that unleash or let loose or allow to bring that very theatrical sensibility, even a stage set sensibility, to this sprawling novel?
Well, I think for one thing, you know, in a funny way, it liberates it. You know, while constraining it to that kind of setting, it liberates it from that kind of literalism that I think so many period dramas suffer from, you know, where there are so many shots of carriages pulling up to palaces. And, you know, it becomes sort of, I think that it becomes sort of fetishistic in its attention to period detail and getting the clothes right and the material.
A regular historical drama. But here, I mean, I was, at first, I was confused by it. And there's almost a Moulin Rouge sort of crazy swirling feeling to it. Did you have the sense in the end that it gets to the depth that you might with a more sober-paced historical dramatic presentation or beyond what you might that way?
You know, to my mind, it did. And it's interesting. I'm, you know, if you and your listeners are reading the book, you'll know what I mean when I say. I came in with one scene from the book in my mind that I thought, if he includes this scene, he's got me at hello. And
name
it's the mowing scene. If you remember Levin with the peasants when he joins them in the mowing, which to my mind is one of the most beautiful scenes ever written.
And this is old-fashioned mowing with a scythe.
With a scythe, yeah.
In a tall wheat.
And he does include a quick, and I wanted to point this out too.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of adaptations really focus on the Anna Vronsky romance and the tragic romance of that. This movie takes us into the stories of Kitty and Levin, and also to Steva and Dolly, two other satellite, and to Levin's brother and his lover.
Mm-hmm.
So there are these three satellite stories that are just as morally important, if not more morally important, to the book.
You've got the dashing Vronsky and the aristocratic Anna, who falls for him head over heels. You've got Levin, who's the sort of man of the people, rural aristocrat who goes for true love, and then Oblonsky and Anna's brother and his philandering and all the mess that makes in his household. I've got a little tape here, if I may, Anne. This is just a moment where Anna Karenina, played by Keira Knightley, and Count Vronsky, played by Aaron Taylor-Johnson, share a fraught moment.
I could change my mind and you'll never see me again.
If you have any thought for me, you will give me back my peace.
I have no peace to give. There could be no peace for us. Only misery, my greatest happiness.
No peace, only misery or greatest happiness. What about the romance right at the heart of it? And if, I don't know, if David Petraeus and Paula Broadwell go to see it, what will they come away thinking?
Well, you know, I think they'll feel pretty bad. I mean, I think what Tolstoy wants us to think about is how to be good. You know, it's really, and one of Wright's reasons for staging it the way he did was that so much of 19th century Russia was performance, you know, in terms of the aristocracy copying French mannerisms, and mm-hmm. They were very oriented toward others in terms of how to behave. So this staging lets that metaphor play out, but it also is about moral agency, and that's where Kitty and Levin and Dolly and Steva all come into play. These are all people who are trying to find their own ways of loving and marrying the idea of romantic love and moral goodness and sacrifice and service. And I think those are really the essential elements of the book that just come shining through in this adaptation, that in ways that they haven't in movies that have been based on the film before. So I think that people, you know, it's no matter sort of where you find yourself in these four couples, I think some people might feel a little guilty and like they can do a little bit better, and others might find a path forward.
And we can all learn. Sounds like a thumbs up from you, Anne.
Definitely, definitely.
Anne Hornaday, movie critic for The Washington Post, with us from Baltimore. Anne, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
It's been filmed many times. Here from 1935, Anna Karenina. Anna, played by Greta Garbo, surprised to find that Count Vronsky, played by Frederick March here in 1935, has followed her from Moscow to St. Petersburg. Here they meet when she gets off the train.
May I help you at all?
I didn't know you were going back to St. Petersburg so soon. Why this change of plan?
Why? To be where you are. You know that. Forgive me, I had to say it.
You shouldn't. You shouldn't. You must forget it. You said it.
Nothing of you. I'll never forget anything of you.
The train whistle, the music. Let's go to the work itself. Joining us now from Durham, North Carolina, Andrew Kaufman, lecturer in Slavic languages and literatures at the University of Virginia, author of Understanding Tolstoy. Andrew Kaufman, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And with us from Durham, Carol Apollonio, professor of Slavic and Eurasian studies at Duke University. Carol, wonderful to have you here as well.
Thank you for having us.
Now, I know you've both just seen the film. We'll come to the book. Film first. Carol, what do you say? You know this book so very well. What do you make of this light operatic treatment of this great sprawling novel?
Well, I wasn't expecting to like it because I love the novel so much. It's such a great experience to sit and read the whole thing page by page. And knowing that it's a theatrical treatment and that it's very stylized scared me. But I loved the film. I just loved it. The director, the everything, the acting, the staging, really was a masterpiece of, I think, film art.
Clears your high bar and then some, it sounds like. Andrew, how about you?
I wish I could create some controversy, but I saw it with Carol and I loved it too. We were both kind of embarrassed that there were moments that we have read countless times and this movie still rendered us to tears. Over those moments, the proposal scene between Kitty and Levin, the mowing scene. One of the things that I thought was so brilliant that the earlier guest mentioned, the choice of filming it on a stage makes perfect sense to Tolstoy, because this was a spectacle society, a society focused more on show than substance. And the movie really captured that essence of this world. And then by choosing to film the Levin scenes in a realistic setting, was also very inspired because Levin is one of the few characters in this book who is actually connected to something real and authentic. And this movie visually communicated that. And that
take you right off the stage set when he appears and into real fields of wheat or real working mowing, you name it. But does it get to the core thing, what you call the cursed question, what Russians call that, you remind us, Andrew. Who am I? How to be good? Is that highlighted here?
Who am I? Why am I here? How should I live? Those are the kind of three essential questions that that the Russian writers deal with in this novel. And what I loved about the movie is it has that philosophical depth, which I'm not used to seeing in other adaptations of Anna Karenina. By taking Levin seriously, by recognizing that Levin is the moral center of this book, that he finds answers to the questions that Anna never can find answers to.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Anna Karenina, Tolstoy's great novel of passion, desire, despair, love, and how we should live. It's back on the big screen. Andrew Kaufman from the University of Virginia joins us, and Carol Apollonio of Duke's Slavic and East and Eurasian, Studies Department, both here today from Durham, North Carolina. British director Joe Wright has put this one on a kind of jewel box stage set, as Anne Hornaday reminded us. And here's a little bit from the new film, Where Levin. And this is the He Who Would Be Good, played by Donald Gleason, talks about marriage with Anna's brother, the womanizing Prince Oblonsky, Stephen, played by Matthew McFadden. Oblonsky here muses on the challenges of love.
It's so unfair. You marry for love. You're a good husband. Children arrive. Years depart. And all of a sudden, your wife grows old and tired. And her hair is thin. And her body. And you yourself, you still have your vigor. And then you find yourself a martyr to distraction by so many women.
Forgive me, but I find that incomprehensible.
Levin finds it incomprehensible. Ika's calling from New Orleans, Louisiana. Ika, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you think?
I think that a need of the priority of righteous morals was imparted into films based upon making the female feel as if her amoralistic character was worse than a male's. And I think that it was portrayed when Anna Karenina in the beginning goes to see her sister and her husband to reunite the husband and wife after his affair with another woman.
Oblonsky, and you think movies have pushed harder on the theme of moral righteousness than Tolstoy himself, Ika?
I believe so. When you read the book, you really feel that Anna's feelings are tormented because of procuring the sentiment lost from her marriage, shown by the reuniting of her with her husband for the sake of the son. Right?
Yes, yes. But was it pushed harder in the movies? I love that question. Carol, what about it? In this movie, in earlier versions, what about the way Tolstoy handles Anna's sojourn in the Garden of Desire and judgment or not judgment? Who's tougher?
Well, Tolstoy, I think, wanted to judge Anna. It seems like a pretty simple issue. You don't cheat on your husband. And he created this character with that in mind and came to love her and came to depict her as a real human being. And so ultimately, it becomes a tragedy. It becomes a universal story about how hard it is for us to live in our own bodies and how hard it is for us to live in a social system or in a family mm-hmm. where the structures really challenge our truest inner feelings. And that's the drama, and it continues through the entire novel from beginning to end.
Andrew, does that mean that it was a different story in 19th century imperial Russia with its very demanding social expectations, certainly in Anna Karenina's class? Does it have the same
tension now, maybe in a time when our social expectations are not so high as they were then, or do I underestimate our social expectations today?
Well, clearly, the 19th century, the social mores and the expectations were very different. But I think you mentioned earlier the name General Petraeus. I think we can open the newspapers today and find plenty of examples of people, men, women, and men, who are struggling with the very same issues, which is, in the case of Anna, this is an incredibly vital woman. This is a passionate woman, as is her brother, Oblonsky, as we see from the clip that you played earlier.
The philanderer, who says, my wife grows old and I'm still full of vigor.
So the question is, how, as a passionate person, as a person who is seeking something authentic in life, how can you be that person and do it within the context of the constraints of reality, of social reality? And that question is as alive today as it was in the 1870s when Tolstoy wrote this novel.
Here's a moment from the 1948 version of Anna Karenina. Here, Anna is played by Vivian Leigh. Of course, she of Gone with the Wind and much more. She's greeted at the St. Petersburg train station by her husband, Karenin, played by Ralph Richardson here. She spent the train ride from Moscow to St. Petersburg talking with the mother of the dashing Count Vronsky, not realizing that he himself, Vronsky, has followed her back to St. Petersburg.
See what a kind, devoted husband you have, just as in the old days, burning with desire to see you, my dear. Not too bad a night?
How is Sergei?
Is that all the reward I get for my devotion? He's quite well, quite well. I let him come to see you. He's in the carriage.
Ah.
Did you have a good night, madame?
Yes, yes, thank you. Very good. Count Vronsky.
I believe I have the honor of your acquaintance. It seems, my dear, you went with the mother and came back with the son.
It all sounds very proper in those 1948 accents, but there the kind and devoted husband gazes upon the dashing Vronsky, who will sweep Anna away. Eileen in Watertown, Massachusetts. Eileen, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I've read the novel three times, when I was 16, when I was 30, and then most recently at 50.
Wow, fantastic.
And I'm just amazed by how it changes in your life cycle.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the novel. I saw the movie on Sunday night with my 18-year-old daughter, my 14-year-old daughter, and my husband.
Oh, boy, what a crew to see this one with. That's interesting in itself. What do you think?
Well, we all liked the movie. My husband loved it, but he's never read the book. My 18-year-old daughter and I read the book 2 years ago when she was 16, and we have known about the movie coming out for a year and a half, so we were really looking forward to seeing it. But after we left, we still felt like we needed to make another version of the movie.
What was missing?
I still felt like we had seen the Vivian Leigh version from 1948, and I still felt like there's a lot of artifice, and I don't know. I didn't feel as swept away into Russia as I wanted to be.
Certainly with that kind of light opera, it's not the same serious sweep me away.
Right. I was wondering, we were really struck by the two scenes. One is when the horse race is happening. Vronsky's on the beautiful white horse.
Mm-hmm.
The horse dies. I've always seen the horse as representing Anna herself. And then later, Anna goes to, I think it's the opera. Vronsky warns her not to go out. And when she gets there, people are gossiping about her and saying, you know, she broke the law, but that was okay. But now she's broken the rules. And she walks in this beautiful white dress with this sparkling necklace on, which she's also wearing at the beginning of the film.
Yes.
When she's dancing at the ball and stealing Vronsky away from Kitty.
And all the social censure of the opera evening comes down on her.
Exactly.
Yeah, those are great scenes.
Had any comments?
Well, we'll look at those. May I ask you, having read the book at 16, 30, and 50, let's say,
yeah,
how was it different at those ages each?
Well, at 16, I was totally in love with Levin. I mean, I was obsessed with him.
The good guy.
Like, looking for my Levin, right?
And right. The sincere, the true, the believer in love.
Yeah, and then when I read it around 30, I can't still remember if it was just before my first child was born or right after he was born, but as a parent, you have a completely different feeling about the book, and Anna's relationship with her son is so emotional.
Yeah.
And you know, she goes, they don't show this in the movie, but in the book she goes off to Italy for a period of time with Vronsky, and it's her love for her son that makes her she has to come back to Russia because of her son, and that is the total heartbreaker as an adult.
Of course, but of course,
mother,
at the same
right.
time, she's left her son to go to Italy with Vronsky, so she makes the tension. And at 50, were you more or less sympathetic with Anna?
I don't know. I probably less sympathetic, actually. I mean, I came out of the movie saying, why do people ruin their lives? Why do they do this? And why do they, you know, especially, I don't know, when you have children, I think it's really hard to break off a relationship with the other parent.
And
I don't
see, know. See it all go so badly. Eileen, thank you. Thank you for that. Andrew Kaufman, take us to the scene where Vronsky rides the horse, Frou Frou breaks the back of the horse at the steeplechase race, and where Tolstoy is taking us there, Andrew.
Well, this is after Vronsky has just learned that Anna is pregnant, and so there's a real downward shift, a
real moment.
Yeah, and so of course Tolstoy prepares us with that detail. He goes to the race. This is his horse, Frou Frou, with whom he has an extremely intimate relationship. And so the connections that a lot of people see between Frou Frou and Anna are very real. They're there in the novel. And he drives this horse to win the race. He drives this horse to basically collapse on the track. The horse breaks his back, and Vronsky has no choice but to shoot the horse. In the novel, Tolstoy says this is the first time in Vronsky's life that he realizes that he has been responsible for some tragedy in somebody else's life. And that really hits home. Vronsky is, in many ways, a very immature guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's a player. He's morally and spiritually immature. And this is a moment of awakening for him. And, of course, this would foreshadow the kinds of decisions, the kinds of things that would happen to him in his relationship with Anna, where he is really in over his head.
But nevertheless, she ends up desperately wounded, to say the least. Carol, is this a gender power lesson that we see? If the horse is kind of the stand-in for Anna and the horse, has its back broken in this chase?
Oh, dear. I find the novel so much more profound, I think, than it's more human. Indeed, the gender aspect is there. The horse is clearly feminine, the female. The Vronsky loves the horse, and in the encounter with the horse before the race, she's on edge. She's incredibly nervous and sensitive, and the way that he causes her to fall is he loses his concentration for just 1 minute. It's a very sensitive issue, and he does, because he knows Anna is in the audience. What I love about the staging of the scene in this movie is that really both this scene and the scene that the caller mentioned before of Anna at the theater have Anna as the center of attention, and the horse also. And the theater, even though she's sitting in the audience, she is actually the star of the mm-hmm. scene in both cases.
Mm-hmm.
So the conceit, I guess you could say, the structuring of the film around a theatrical set really has profound meaning and resonates with the way Tolstoy created it. In the film, what I love that was different from the novel is that when Vronsky falls, Anna leaps from her chair and screams out his name.
Yes.
At the top of
and
her voice.
And everyone turns. What?
And the rest of the film and the rest of the theater is completely silent. Of course, this is different from what happens in the novel. It's outdoors in the novel, and mm-hmm. it's just her facial expression that conveys that. Her husband is the one who notices.
And right, but here it's big. It's big drama, and everybody sees it.
It's all about Anna.
And the irony is that she screams out the name Alexei, but Alexei is also the name of her husband. And so in the movie, her husband comes up and says, "I'm here," thinking mm-hmm. that she has screamed out his name. And that's an extremely powerful moment that reminds moviegoers that Anna has basically gone from one Alexei to
yes.
another.
Yes,
that's an interesting little detail.
She sure has. Clint is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Clint, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My question is, when I heard that Keira Knightley was going to be playing the role of Anna Karenina, I'm a big fan of the book, and it made me a big fan of Tolstoy. My reaction was that she just seems too young to play that part. My impression of Anna when I read the book was of someone in their maybe late 30s or early 40s,
yeah.
And I didn't know if the people that saw the movie, if that took them out of the movie a little bit, and I mean, Keira Knightley being so young for that part.
That's a great question, Clint. I mean, in fairness, Keira Knightley's no longer the, what, teenager playing Bend It Like Beckham. But then what age was Anna in the book, Carol? Where would you place her? And what about Keira Knightley's visage in that role? Uh-huh.
I have to say, I was worried about Keira Knightley too, partly because she is sensitive and thin and sort of exotic. In the book, actually, Anna is fleshy, and Tolstoy emphasizes
that. Broad shouldered at one
point.
I was just reading.
Exactly. She's really physically plumped out, I guess I could say. It's not our standard of beauty. So that was one thing I was worried about. And the high-strung nature of Keira Knightley's acting is very overt and obvious. I felt she did a beautiful job, actually. She really conveyed the essence of Anna.
But the age question that Clint raises?
Mm-hmm. The age question, I think that Anna was married actually around 18 or so. So she could be close to 30 at this point.
So maybe not so far from Kieran. I don't know what Keira Knightley is now, but she could pass for 30.
Yeah, possibly. Her son is nine years old in the novel, and she presumably had him fairly early in her marriage. So, but yeah, I definitely understand the question. It makes perfect sense to me too. That the types are different.
She certainly brings that taut drama to it, though.
I have to say,
Wendy in Townsend, Massachusetts. Wendy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just calling in to say that I can't bring myself to see the movie. I love that book. I read it 2 years ago. I'm 50 now, and I really appreciated all that Tolstoy can find in a woman's passion and just how he depicted it in the story. I finished the story, and I wept. I wept because of the ending, but also just because I felt so there in the book that I can't bring myself to see the movie. I think it might ruin it.
Andrew, what's your advice to Wendy, who loves it too much to sully it with a cinema image?
So let me tell Wendy that I had the same fear as did Carol. This is a book that I have read countless times. I've written about it. I know it inside and out, and I always wondered what could a movie possibly add or give me that's not already in the book. And what astounded me about this movie is that it showed me aspects of the book that that I hadn't seen before, or shows them in a new light. An adaptation, in my view, should not be an imitation. It should be an interpretation. An interpretation that brings an old book alive in exciting new ways for a contemporary audience. And this movie did that for me, someone who's been with this book for almost 20 years. So I hope that's enough encouragement for Wendy to go give this movie a chance.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about Anna Karenina, Tolstoy's great novel of passion, desire, despair, love, and of how we should live. It is back on the big screen, directed by Joe Wright. Keira Knightley's there, and more. Andrew Kaufman is with us from the University of Virginia. Carol Apollonio from Duke University. Here's a little bit more from the film. Anna, played by Keira Knightley, and her husband, Alexei, played by Jude Law, talk after a party where she spent the evening, very obviously, with the handsome Count Vronsky.
You and Count Vronsky attracted attention tonight.
You don't like it when I don't talk to people, and you don't like it when I do.
I didn't notice anything myself, but I saw everyone else noticed. I consider jealousy to be insulting to you and degrading to me. I have no right to inquire into your feelings. They concern only your conscience. But that's my duty to remind you that we are bound together by God. And this bond can only be broken by a crime against God.
I have nothing to say to you.
We're bound together by God. I have nothing to say to you. Andrew Carroll, lots of response from people online. Italo reminds us of that, of course, that opening line. All happy families are alike. Each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Chris says, character development here so rich. I knew these people, Chris writes. Timeless. Daphne says, you know, technology has changed, but the human condition has not changed that much over time. And Gary responds to her, the human condition has not changed at all. What about that, Carol? Do you look around and see the same people around you that we find in the pages of Tolstoy's Anna Karenina?
Oh, absolutely. They're wearing different clothing, that's all. But it's they're really the same human beings. You know Tolstoy's characters as well as you know most people you know in the real world, because you live with them in their minds. You understand their inner thoughts. You clearly understand why they're doing what they do. It's universal. It's free of the constrictions of time, Tolstoy's work is.
Ellen in Melrose, Massachusetts, you're on the air, Ellen. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
I was just wondering what the guests think Tolstoy's reaction to the movie would be, especially since he was known for his aversion to glitz and glamour.
Oh, there's a mental exercise. Andrew, how about it? Put Leo himself in the theater. What do you think, in the cinema?
That is a brilliant question. One part of Tolstoy would be put off by the glitz and the glamour, as the caller mentioned, but another, even deeper part of Tolstoy would have loved the movie because he wanted his books to live. He wanted his books to be revitalized. He didn't want them to collect dust in the library shelves. And that's what this movie did for Anna Karenina. And the other thing that it did is it got to the deeper essence of the book. Even though some of the details and some of the scenes, even though the adaptation is not 100% faithful to the original in terms of being an imitation, it is faithful, very faithful to the essence of the original, to the feeling, to the tone, to the depth of, and the complexity of the emotions. And so for that reason, I think Tolstoy would have given this film a thumbs up.
Carol, play the exercise. Put the great man himself in one of those theater seats watching Keira Knightley and all the rest. What do you think?
Oh, my gosh. I think that Tolstoy at a certain point, you know, after he wrote the novel, he gave up writing fiction for a while. I have this view that the novel is about as perfect as a piece of literature can be. And he kind of imploded, I think. He could not create anything more perfect. And he gave up writing literature. In his books, indeed, that's true. I love the question, too. It was absolutely brilliant. He felt that the theater was artificial and that it was a corrupting influence on people. So part of the problem is, I guess, that film, there was no such thing as film when Tolstoy was alive.
That would
alive.
Be a shock in itself. Once he got past
he might faint just at the very thought.
Right.
So the way that it works as art is something that Tolstoy was conflicted about, not the novel, but just generally the way art works on people, because it's artificial in a way. So I find it a very deep question that's difficult to really solve. And that's the best kind of question, isn't it?
Looking through a mirror, through the theater,
right,
to the cinema.
The best, who wants to get the right answer to any question?
Let's get to, here's Anatoly calling from Newton, Massachusetts. Anatoly, thank you so much. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Hello to everybody. I read the novel first in Russian back in Moscow.
Wonderful.
And then I saw this film. And I think the film tried too hard, especially the main character, Anna Karenina. Of course, she was too skinny, too athletic, and not quite motherly as Tolstoy portrayed her. But my point is that Tolstoy's work was philosophical. Of course, Levin is his autobiographical character, as you know.
Yes, the good Levin.
He went to his village and he walked barefoot in his village, although he was a count and aristocrat himself. But he rejected the society, and at one point he was excommunicated from the church for defending Jews. But the film became, I think, too schematic in pushing his philosophy.
And what with that, what do you think it missed, Anatoly?
It missed a more realistic portrayal of Russia, and it missed the music by Tchaikovsky that was based on that folk song "Vopoli Beryoza Stayala," they sing the folk song, but they they don't play Tchaikovsky there. I was disappointed at that.
And until you're a wonderful reader with a good eye on the film, and I'm grateful for that. Keira Knightley, too skinny, not motherly. I'll take that to my guest, but I wonder, Carol, if you might, against or alongside that comment, put something from the book itself here. There's this great scene, a couple of paragraphs from it here, where Vronsky and Anna Karenina make their appearance at the opera when everybody knows what's up with them. And he sees her, and then he sees her being suffering real social censure right there in that great scene of the opera setting in the audience. He first spots her, and then comes her moment of humiliation. Could you read for us from that, Carol?
Yeah, exactly. I think the important thing is they've come separately after a fight. He tells her not to go because he knows that it will be a scandal. So they've come separately, and he's not with her, and he makes the rounds of the whole audience before. So Vronsky, listening with one ear, moved his opera glass from the stalls and scanned the boxes. Near a lady in a turban and a bald-headed old man who blinked angrily just as Vronsky's moving glass reached him, he suddenly caught sight of Anna's proud head, strikingly beautiful and smiling in its frame of lace. She was in the fifth box in the lower tier, not more than 20 paces away. She sat in front of the box and, half leaning round, was saying something to Yashvin. The poise of her head on her lovely broad shoulders and the restrained excitement and brilliance of her eyes and of her whole face reminded him of her just as he had seen her at the ball in Moscow, but he felt utterly different towards her beauty now. In his feeling for her now, there was no element of mystery. And so her beauty, though it attracted him even more than before, gave him now a sense of injury. She was not looking in his direction, but Vronsky felt that she had already seen him. Vronsky could not discern exactly what had passed between the Kartasovs in the neighboring box and Anna, but he saw that something humiliating for Anna had happened. He realized this both from what he had seen and more especially from Anna's face. He could see she was taxing every nerve to sustain the role she had taken up, and she was entirely successful in appearing outwardly tranquil. Anyone who did not know her in her circle, who had heard none of the utterances of commiseration, indignation, and amazement that she should show herself in society, and show herself so ostentatiously with her lace and her beauty, would have admired the serenity and loveliness of this woman without a suspicion that she was undergoing the sensations of a man in the stocks.
Oh, fantastic tension. And in that, capturing that moment where she suffers, he's viewing from afar, he knows what she's suffering, but she keeps up the appearance, or tries to, Carol.
Exactly. And she's completely alone in this public space. That aloneness that she arrives at this point in the novel is a kind of culmination of her plot, which is a plot from integration into society, where she's a wife, a mother, she has a social circle, she's a respected woman. And the entire novel has tracked her as she gradually leaves behind all of her social contacts. And here is the kind of culminating scene where she is utterly alone.
Andrew, what do you think of our Anatoly calling in saying, yes, but too schematic here in the movie and following the deeper glory of the book?
I would reiterate what I mentioned earlier. Anatoly, Russians grow up with this novel. Anatoly probably knows this novel inside and out. Russians are assigned to read it in high school. I think it's the 11th grade. I think War and Peace is in the 10th grade. So this is a book that Anatoly probably knows very, very well. But I think I would encourage Anatoly just to sort of widen the box a little bit and think about, rather than trying to be a perfect imitation of the novel as he understands it and he knows it, this movie was trying to universalize the novel, was trying to get at the essence of the novel, and doing so in a different medium by playing with some of the techniques, rearranging some of the details that would work in the film medium. Dostoevsky once called himself a realist. He said, "I'm not a realist, but I'm a realist in a higher sense. I'm a realist in the higher sense." And in many ways, Tolstoy was that as well. His realism, even though it is true to life as we understand it, there's also something beyond those things that we see and hear and experience every day, those deeper feelings, those frustrations. And that's at the deepest level. That's what this book is. That's what this book is about. And I think the movie did an excellent job of capturing that dimension in the medium of film.
A realist in a higher sense. Carol, we had a caller earlier, a woman saying that she appreciated Tolstoy's grasp of a woman's passion here. I mean, you can hear
in his narration of that scene of the opera, his sympathy for her, in her aloneness, never mind how Vronsky's seeing her, think of how Tolstoy appears to be looking at her, and there's a sympathy for her situation. What about his sympathy for a woman's passion?
That too, that's such a great question as well, because I think that the sensitivity with which he creates this amazing human being, this Anna, probably his finest creation, I think, as a literary character. He's a man, and she's a woman, and yet I think that his ability to convey what it really felt to be like Anna in every level, you know, even physically as a woman, and then her social position, I think is a mark most of all of his brilliance as a novelist, that he is able to create a world that feels real. In my way of thinking about Tolstoy, I think about a word-to-world relationship, and I don't think anyone does it better than Tolstoy. He is an observer at the profoundest depths of human nature, and I think that's why he's able to make us feel that we understand Anna. It's an absolutely true portrayal of a woman in spite of his difference from her.
And his judgment, if that's the right word, we'll look at Levin, but on the kind of passionate love that Vronsky and Anna Karenina have, where does he finally settle it to your mind, Carol?
I really think that the beauty of this novel is that it creates a world that's real. It's not an instruction as to how to live. It's a depiction of human beings, I guess, literary characters, and choices that they have made and what those choices have led them to. Tolstoy is a judge. He's a moralistic writer, but he is also an incredible realist. We know that he judges her, and at the same time, we know that he loves her as well.
And yet you write, or I've said, Andrew, that he raises here and elsewhere the cursed question, who am I? Why am I here? How should I live? Mm-hmm. But without instruction, is there not instruction in his depiction?
A couple of ways to think about that. One is that Tolstoy isn't so much offering answers as an attitude. He's giving us an attitude towards life, which is one, and he's encouraging us to come alive, to look at things more deeply, to feel more passionately, to act more authentically, to continually ask ourselves those questions of ourselves. What is it that really is important to me? Oblonsky doesn't ask those questions. Vronsky doesn't ask those questions.
They just chase women.
So by simply even becoming aware that these are questions, that the question of morality is a question, that there are choices that we make, and that these choices have an effect in other people's lives, that in itself is already a kind of instruction in a world in which people simply are on autopilot, on spiritual autopilot.
So then take his autobiographical character, if you will, as Anatoly says, Levin, the aristocrat from the countryside who goes back there to the village, who mows in the field with his scythe alongside the peasants, who finds a ecstatic, deep love with Kitty. What's the model that he's putting there up alongside the Vronsky Anna Karenina model, Andrew?
So the very interesting thing about Levin that not all readers get the first time around is that Levin and Anna are very, very similar characters. Levin and Anna are actually struggling with very similar issues. They're both extremely vital, extremely passionate people. They balk at falsity and hypocrisy. They need something authentic in their lives. And they too are, they're both searching for a kind of love. So the fact that these two characters are very similar suggests that when Levin ends up finding in the end what Anna never could. He ends up finding a way to express that authenticity within the limits of social reality, within the limits of society as it actually exists. And for Tolstoy, the only way to do that was within a family, within the context of family. And the minute you get rid of that context of family, everything unravels, Tolstoy believed.
Is Levin a rebuke to Anna Karenina then, Carol, or just an alternative?
Alternative is a word that I was thinking when you asked the question. What I love about Tolstoy's construction of the novel is that these, indeed, as Andy said, that these are two characters who are the most real and the most authentic, and they have the deepest struggle, but they have a different trajectory through the novel. Anna begins integrated into society and ends up completely isolated, but with Levin, it's the opposite. He begins alone, And the novel is his struggle to join into a society that he's not completely satisfied with at any level. They begin at different places and they end at different places, but their paths reflect each other and are parallel.
And a great, great drama along the way. Well, who knows who may find this gift under the Christmas tree or elsewhere this particular holiday when infidelity's been so much in the news. Maybe people could use it. Wonderful to have you both with us. Carol Apollonio at Duke University, thank you so much for your insights and time today. Just great to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me.
And Andrew Kaufman, University of Virginia. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thank you, Tom. It was great being here.
Author of Understanding Tolstoy. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. Tip of the hat to Anna Karenina. Thank you, Tolstoy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll go out with a little more music from the movie. This is On Point.